Welcome to a community conversation with Alaska Constitutional Conventioner Vic Fisher, recorded live at Kachemak Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College on Tuesday, October 25th. The views expressed by the participants are theirs alone and do not reflect the opinions of KBBI, volunteers, staff, or board. Some participants are identified, like Alaska Representative Paul Seaton, but Community Conversations has a tradition of not requiring speakers to identify themselves, so KBBI respects that policy by not identifying speakers who don't identify themselves. Here's host Mike Hallfield to introduce Vic Fisher and get the conversation rolling.
As many of you know about Vic Fisher, know his story. You may be familiar with his autobiography, To Russia with Love, in which he tells us about from when he was born in Berlin and raised in Moscow, his family having escaped the rise of the Nazi program in Germany, and went to Moscow, where ultimately they would escape from Moscow, Stalinist Moscow, come to the United States. Vic joined the United States Army and served during World War II, and after the war, to Alaska, as so many did, with ideas of all the opportunity that Alaska has to offer. And of course, what an amazing time that must have been to be in the territory, especially to come here and having served in the military and having seen the horrors of authoritarian regimes in Europe, to find that, well, you can't vote. You know, you're a territorial. He and many others began to work on the statehood project. And that, of course, centered so much on getting people out to vote. Vic wants to talk about that tonight, talk about the preciousness of the ballot, the vote, and civic engagement. We also have Jane Ann Vig with us. Speaking of civic engagement, she's a byword for civic engagement. I can't begin the long list of things she's been engaged in, but as an Alaska Woman of the Year, that sums up a great deal of who she is. And so we're very happy to have her here as well. So please, let's welcome Vic Fisher to the front.
Can you hear me back there? All right, the system works. If we are all very nice, we'll get to watch the Cubs play the Indians. I really don't want to talk to you. I really want to participate in a community conversation. I'll give you a few words in advance. There's so much to talk about in this particular campaign season. We've probably all gotten pretty tired of many aspects of it. As Mike was giving you some of my background, I flashed for the first time in many years even thinking about it, was elections in the Soviet Union when I was young, when I was a kid. They actually had elections. Once a year or once every 2 years or whatever, there would be a big celebration. There'd be flags and banners and lots of radio stuff all about the forthcoming election and the great candidates that we have. My mother describes it in her autobiographic book that election day would come and you'd get your ballot. And there'd be one candidate. And you vote for that candidate. And that is Stalin's platform. This candidate is pledged. He's supported by she is supported by the Communist Party. And that's all there was to it. You had a vote and you cast it. And 99.98% of the votes were for that candidate. There were no other candidates. There must have been some blank pieces of paper. Our situation is totally different. When I came to Alaska in 1950, Alaska lived up to all my expectations. Beauty was phenomenal. My work taking me all over Alaska was fascinating. I made lots of friends, a lot of good friends, young people, older people. Alaska was a small place, and you got to get to know everybody. The one thing I missed was that I was no longer a full-fledged citizen of the United States. I could no longer vote for president and senator and representative as I had before I came to Alaska. We fought a war to protect democracy around the world, and then we veterans came to Alaska. We were not full-fledged citizens. And to me, that was the most important motivation for getting involved in the statehood movement, because we did want to be able to vote for our president, for to have members in the U.S. Senate, to have a member in the House of Representatives, and have our own legislature for the state of Alaska, and have some control over the future of our Alaska. I spoke before class today. Mike was teaching a history and politics class. It was sort of interesting for me to speak about the motivation and how we got involved in statehood as citizens who cared about where we were before statehood, when we were, as Ernest Greening defined, we were a colony of the United States. 99% of, or more, of control over Alaska resided in Washington, D.C. We had a territorial legislature. I served in it for one term. The legislature met for 60 days every 2 years. In 1957, when we approved the budget, it was, as I recollect, about $19 million a year. It was a minuscule operation. We had a territorial government that had virtually no power. The governor of Alaska was appointed by the president upon recommendation of the Secretary of the Interior. In terms of self-government, we were a non-entity. I think the city of Anchorage probably had more control over what's in the city than the territorial legislature had. But even as a territory, we couldn't establish a regional form of government. The Congress says you cannot have counties, which is just as well, we don't have counties. But the reason was that the fishing and mining industries did not want to be taxed. The territorial legislature could not levy property taxes in areas outside the cities. The cities could tax, but only within the city limits. In addition to being Anchorage Planning Director, I was Secretary of the League of Alaskan Cities, which is now the Alaska Municipal League. We were trying to get home rule powers for cities in Alaska. The territorial legislature did not have the authority to give home rule powers to the cities. I talked and corresponded with a non-voting delegate to Congress, Bob Bartlett, and he said, we can do that with statehood. We couldn't get a bill like that through Congress. You know, Congress didn't want to bother with little things like that in Alaska. To those of us who were involved in the statehood movement, the voting was a critical aspect of becoming a state. I would say that we have done quite well over the decades. The Constitutional Convention met 60 years ago. There was no question about the right to vote. Voting age under the territory was 21. We had a big discussion at the convention what it should be. Some of us young ones advocated for 18 years of age. Others, mostly older ones, thought that that's way too early, even though we felt we were in the military, in the war, at 18. And if we could fight in the war, we should be able to vote. Well, we compromised at 19. There was a question of what requirements there should be. The previous requirement was to read and write the English language and such other requirements as may exist. In the South, this meant you have to interpret, read the Constitution, interpret what it means, and so on, to keep certain elements from voting. That existed to some extent in Alaska. The Constitution thoroughly liberalized that requirement. Everyone could vote. Today, we're to the point where we do have early voting. Has anyone here voted? A number of hands in back went up. Congratulations. That is a big step forward. In other states, people have been voting for a couple of weeks already. In some states, they have to wait till election day. But I think Alaska is moving in the right direction. We have a ballot proposition before us on having automatic voter registration with a permanent fund dividend application. And thank you, Paul, for, I assume you voted for it. He did. I think that's going to be a step forward. There are interests that are trying to tell us that's bad and vote no. I have enough trust in Alaskans to feel that that will go. We have, what's the other proposition? Bonding for college loans. I think that's an easy one. It's an easy yes vote. We have something else coming up. In the Constitutional Convention, we had a choice of specifically voting on shall we have a merit-based judiciary in Alaska, or should we elect our judges? Overwhelmingly, the Constitutional Convention voted to have a merit-based system on a nonpartisan basis to make recommendations to the governor, who then appoints one of two or more candidates brought before the governor. We've had a number of elections where we Alaskans got to vote on a question, shall there be a constitutional convention? To date, in each of these votes, the answer has been no, when that question was put properly. One of the big reasons has been that we have a nonpartisan judiciary. A new constitutional convention can change every aspect, every element, every word of the Constitution. And the concern has been time and again that political interest might want to undermine the nonpartisan, merit-based judiciary. We have an attack now on the judiciary because there's a provision in the Constitution that judges after 3 years will stand for a retention vote. We have two justices who are up for retention vote in this current election. They're under attack for a specific decision that has been made by the Alaska Supreme Court. Based on a one decision, there's a religious movement to reject these two justices. We have the right to vote. One sometimes gets concerned about what will happen if there is a groundswell. And we have a question like that in our presidential election. What's going to happen there? The odds are in one direction, but this is a free country. And we have a situation where we have gotten involved in outlandish situation with a lot of horrible name-calling. I don't have to get into that. I would just like to turn it over to this group. I would be glad to answer any questions, make any comment on whatever, or watch as a discussion goes within this entire group. I'm just here as a foil for this particular event.
What I would like to do, I'm going to ask Wayne Natterholt to take charge of the mic and take it to anyone who has a question. At the beginning, I should have mentioned that the folks on the screen behind me are our fellow audience members from the Kenai River campus of KPC. Oh. So, hi, guys.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing? Let's begin.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Vic.
I'm new here. I've been here a couple of years and came from California, and I was a professional in real estate. In California, we have procedures. We have procedures for putting public notice out for large projects that are frequently incented by the government, infrastructure, where it would affect private property owners. Is that something that is complicated in this state to put into effect, or is that viewed as something in the way of progress?
Well, in terms of public notice, the key provision in the Alaska Constitution deals not with individual projects that might affect property owners. It deals with actions of the state government pertaining to disposal of resources through sale, lease, or otherwise. The public notice is required. We had a case recently having to do with the Pebble Mine, where the issue of public notice not having been given was one of the elements of plaintiffs. And the Supreme Court ruled in behalf of the plaintiffs that notice has to be given. So the concept of notice exists, and that may be even on small disposals and so on. That has to be done, even leases. In terms of projects, my experience at the local level particularly is that there's always public notice. At the municipal level, for instance, there is public notice, there are public hearings before the assembly, before the city council, whatever. In terms of vote, if it entails bonds, GO bonds, the legislature has to authorize it. It can't be done by an agency. In terms of effect and vote by property owners, I'm not familiar with that. Does anyone know any examples?
Oh, go ahead, Franco.
At the city level, most projects do public notice. Also at the borough level, when things come to the borough planning commission, it's always public notice given, so it's a tradition here.
Right, and property owners always have the right to speak and express themselves.
Paul, you had a question?
I don't think we have a record of running roughshod over property owners. If we did, we'd probably have a reaction to it.
And Vic, I'd just like to add that possibly in the last few years you haven't seen many because we haven't had any new projects coming with the budget. There's a lot that are still in the works, but those had all the supplemental environmental impact statements and all of those kind of things that go into that, and the legislature has to make all appropriations. So that comes through the legislative process, and there is there's hearings on every one of those. So that's the state process, that every appropriation has to be made by the legislature, and there's hearings before all of those issues on the budget.
Why don't you address the audience?
Yes, sir. I believe this is the first state election where we have Yupik and Inupiat interpreters.
Yeah.
And I was wondering a little bit of the history from the Constitution, how we changed the right to vote.
We removed the strict requirements that used to exist under territorial status. Those were eliminated. There still is language. I haven't got my constitution with me. There still is language saying that the ability to read or write or something, the English language. Yupik and Cupic and other language assistance that's being provided now have come about because of federal requirements applying across the whole United States to assure that voters have an understanding of what they're voting on.
Sir, why did it take the federal government to initiate this after all these years of statehood?
My assumption would be, Paul, why did it take the federal government? Why didn't the legislature do it?
Well, the legislature is sometimes slow. And I believe we had some court action that said that, you have to provide opportunity. It's not only that, it's Tagalog and other languages that are spoken so that people can understand what they're voting on. And that's one of the things that I hope we can get into as we talk about this, because trying to provide at every polling station where there may be people that speak other languages as their primary language is an extremely difficult thing to provide at every polling station where there may be those minorities that speak other languages. So I hope that as we get into the ballot question, we can discuss that as well as I know that if we go like to the mail-in ballot, so there's three, everybody has the ballots 3 weeks or 4 weeks before the election, then you could have a circulating people that could go two or three times to each to each village or to each area, and whether that would give opportunity, better opportunity than trying to provide that everywhere only on Tuesday. And so hopefully, as the legislature is considering things, that's one of the things we'll be looking at, is how do we improve ballot access and ballot understanding. And so that's, a lot of things have happened through the courts and what's fair and equitable for everybody and for understanding what they're voting.
I might just add that with mail-in ballots, absentee voting and mail-in ballots now being able to request ballots electronically, to vote electronically, the next step may well be there'll be enough technology that the individual will have time to look at the issues at the ballot, and with automatic translation being available to anybody everywhere. Paul, remember.
I'd just be interested in getting your take on how we make those we do vote for, how we can allow our Supreme Court to go with only 8 justices. Don't you have a constitutional duty as being one who's voted in for our judicial system to operate the way it's supposed to? Senators are saying that they will not support any Supreme Court justice that Hillary Clinton would appoint should she become president. I mean, if this happened in the state, in our state, what mechanism do we have to prevent that from happening, I guess?
Our state has so far functioned effectively on that particular issue. We had a vacancy on the Supreme Court a number of years ago, but in this century, the Judicial Council reviewed candidates and they sent two to the governor. The governor gets to choose one of the two. Or if they sent more candidates from whatever panel is sent to him. This governor said he doesn't like either one of them, asked the Judicial Council to send him more names. The Judicial Council said, no way. The Constitution says, this is what we do, and you choose one of the two or more that we send to you. And they refused. So we haven't had that problem because our judicial system doesn't require for the justice nominee to go through the political process. The whole concept was it's a nonpartisan system. The protections are built in. And there literally have been attacks over the years on this nonpartisan system that we have, where the efforts have been made to change the Constitution to provide more members of the Judicial Council that would be appointed by a governor and approved by the legislature. In other words, stacking the Judicial Council with political appointees. They've been rejected, and let's hope they will be.
What I'm concerned about is today, I happen to have just today gotten a phone call this morning from somebody back east who was saying, would you like to buy an Alaska State GO bond, you know, general obligation bond? Just came out, and it's Standard & Poor's AA rating. And I'm thinking, as far dead as we are, how are they putting out new GO bonds and paying 3.49%? And I'm thinking, and then tax-free, by the way, since that's muni. How does our legislature have a chance to seek outside money that way, which makes an obligation for us to pay it down, when we're so far in debt and we can't get the legislature to change where we're getting our money from now, which means readjust what's the deal with the taxes and the oil companies. Somebody's putting out Alaska bonds, and they don't know elsewhere. I answered the fellow by saying, well, I happen to live in Alaska. I don't think I want to buy a bond in Alaska right now. Thank you. We're too far in debt. What would you think we should do?
May I defer to the local legislator?
Right.
Sure. I'm the local legislator they were talking about. The only bonds that I can think of were pension obligation bonds in 2008, when we weren't in this kind of situation, over my objection. The legislature authorized the sale of up to $5 billion of pension obligation bonds if the Department of Revenue determined that that was the right timing for those. Pension obligation bonds are a mechanism where you sell bonds and then you reinvest that money. You're doing it at 3.4%. You're anticipating making 8%, so you can make some on the margin. I oppose that. The governor has pulled those back. There was a meeting with the Senate Finance Committee, because we've been objecting to the issuance of those, because in the financial situation we're in now, we don't believe arbitrage is something that we should be undertaking. So the governor has pulled those back. There may have been somebody issuing those or somebody looking at doing those, but they're not actually issuing those. The only other bonds that could be issued is AHFC or the railroad issue bonds, but those are actually revenue bonds based on the projects. So I have no idea, because we did not pass any general obligation bonds, and a general obligation bond package has to come before a vote of the people of the state of Alaska. We can't just authorize them and go forward. So they have to come before a vote. We sometimes put those forward to transportation bond issue for a bunch of projects, and there may be some of those that were still left from one of those issuances that they are trying to build a road, and they didn't sell the bonds way back when and just hang on to the money. They waited until closer to time for that project. But I'm not familiar with what that project is or what that would be. So the big bond package, the governor put on hold because we were all objecting to it. Pension obligation bonds were bonds that were going to put the amount that we borrowed. I think what they were going out was $3.2 billion, and that money would be put into the state retirement and the teacher retirement system to get that closer to the up into the 90% of funded level. But it's a risky thing, and that's why we've objected, and the governor's pulled back at this point in time.
Vic, what would it take to do something about the legislature's preposterous conflict of interest rules? Was that discussed at the Constitutional Convention? Is it going to take an initiative? The legislators seem to be just fine with how it's working now.
It was not discussed in the Constitutional Convention. The Constitution provides that the houses adopt their own rules, and so it's really up to the legislature to act. Whether an initiative can force the legislature to act, I'm not sure. Just throw the bastards out.
Hey, thanks. Subsistence is a subject that has been around recently. There's obviously a conflict between state and federal laws regarding subsistence. Was there a discussion on subsistence back in the constitutional time, or was that not an issue that was raised at the convention?
It was not an issue during the time of the convention. It was not raised. When it did become an issue, the federal government provided in Anoka, 1981, for a preference for rural residents. In the case of there's a shortage of fish and game, the state enacted legislation to provide a preference for rural residents. Court in 1989 found that unconstitutional. It violated several clauses of the Constitution, including equal access and several others. Then the legislature was asked by the governor and by Senator Stevens and whoever else was in the Senate to initiate and enact a constitutional amendment authorizing preference in the Constitution. Pardon me? The Alaska Constitution. And it went on year after year after year, and the state Senate could not get enough votes to provide for a constitutional amendment, and the feds finally took over management of game and eventually fisheries in federal waters and of federal, essentially federal and related lands and waters.
Vic, back to the ballot for just a minute. One of the things that has been transpiring a lot is that, like in rural Alaska, we saw a number of races where there were only Democrat candidates, and in the election that we had here, we only had Republican candidates. So with the split in the ballots, so that there's a closed primary, so that only part of the electorate gets to choose their members of the legislature, did any of that come up in the constitutional framework, or in your discussions afterwards and now? Do you have particular ways in which you can see solution to that problem, which so many people bring up?
The answer to the first part is no. It was not discussed. It was never conceived, and it probably would not have been provided for, because convention did not want to deal with the, you might say, minutiae, the implementation of certain of all the provisions. In terms of, my answer is, have an open ballot, the way it worked for decades in Alaska. And the legislature could probably deal with that by providing that anyone who closes a ballot pays for the election.
Vic, I get so kind of bored hearing oil, gas, and I wonder, when the Constitutional Convention was setting up Alaska as an owner state, what were all the natural resources, the types of natural resources that the convention looked at as where the funding for our state would come from?
At the time of the Constitutional Convention, oil exploration was just beginning on the Kenai Peninsula. There was nothing much going on. Oil was not expected to be the answer to the future of Alaska. We knew there were mineral resources, but nobody saw mineral resources as the answer, per se, nor oil and gas of any massive scope. We knew there was lots of forestry resources. There were those who thought agriculture may contribute to the future. But above all, I would say that none of us tried to paint a picture of the future. So here is what Alaska will be like. There was no foundation at that point to project the future. The population was small, 150,000 maybe at the time, maybe a little bit more. Heavy military, heavy federal presence, but in terms of resource development, economic foundation, there was nothing, and nobody made an attempt to do it. In writing the Constitution, the fundamental approach was, we are writing for the future, regardless of what it will be, regardless of, and we never said regardless of what, but we wanted a document that provides a structure for the government of the state that sets basic principles for future management of the resources. We knew we'd get 100 million acres of land and with subsurface resources. So that was known. But in terms of what Alaska will be like, even as a planner, I had no way of projecting. There were those who talked about with statehood there'll be millions of people. None of the delegates ever said anything like that. But when we became a state, there were all sorts of projections being made by consultancies hither and yon around the United States and various institutes, again, non-Alaska, who said, oh, this is going to open up and this is blah, 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 going to happen. And there was no basis for doing projections. And this may not be satisfactory, but we do have a constitution that has functioned effectively for 55 years and more. And we've had a few amendments for better and for worse. It's designed to last without any of us today knowing what Alaska will be like 40 years from now.
You know, with all of your perspective and seeing the Constitution and the state in action, and recognizing that probably a constitutional convention opening up the whole Constitution again may not be in the cards because of so many different public interest. Were there any things that you felt would have made it better that you would now put in, or would there be things that maybe you would change?
Janie and I traveled around Alaska on the 50th anniversary of statehood, and and the issue was statehood and Alaska Natives, and we talked about various issues, and one of the things then and still I feel is that the Constitution was written without any regard to the indigenous people who had settled Alaska 10,000 and more years ago. And I would change the preamble to reflect that if I had to do it over again from current perspective. My principal substantive committee work was at local government, and we wanted to streamline local government, not have a lot of overlapping jurisdictions or with frozen boundaries and obsolete rules and strictures. We wanted flexibility for local government to meet the needs of urban areas like Anchorage and rural areas such as much of the other state. And that part has worked well under the home rule provisions. The North Slope is a home rule borough. Anchorage, the largest metropolitan area, is a home rule borough. It's called a municipality, but it's a home rule borough under the same provision as the North Slope. The charters are very different between the two, but they home rule. They're designed and voted on by the people of the regions, and this is true through many other Alaska jurisdictions. Today, and we restricted the local government system to cities and boroughs, cities being the more settled areas, boroughs conceived as more a regional unit. Today, in much of Native Alaska, you have tribal governments. that are functioning. At the time of the convention, the word tribe was not mentioned once. The issue never came up, but from anywhere, by anyone, from inside or outside the convention. Tribes were not active at that point in terms of tribal governance. Today, I would want to work out a way that at the local level, the tribes had a role, a function. There are some aspects that would have to be specifically adapted. If there's a native community and there are non-natives there also, that there would have to be allowance for one vote and some equality. How that would work, I don't know. But that is one aspect that I would want to look at. In terms of changing, we had built a system of districting and an apportionment decennially. It was given to the governor, to the essentially the chief executive of the state, with districting board, and the governor issuing the proclamation. The article was almost completely revised through constitutional amendment, giving distributing the authority to appoint members of the districting board, two to the governor, one to the Speaker of the House, one to the President of the Senate, and a fifth member being Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, appointing appointing one of the five members of the districting board. The result of that has been that you can have four members of one party very easily, instead of making sure that there's a distribution between political parties of the two, at least some representation. I would want to revisit that and specifically look at what the nonpartisan commissions that have been established in several states, how they function, and see what we can adapt to Alaska so that it's not right off the bat either politicized by the governor or politicized by the governor and legislative leaders. Aside from various little ones, but those are the issues I personally would be concerned about to make the system work better.
Wondering about, since you've spent time thinking about the Alaska Constitution, I imagine you probably have thought about the electoral process that we have for the national government. And I'm just wondering if you have any comments on either the Electoral College, if it's still an effective mechanism for us in America. I think almost everyone that I've participated in one, and it's been hugely frustrating because you're given about 30 seconds to explain your point of view and you can't hear the other people at your table. And everyone I think that has participated doesn't really understand why we do it the way we do, but we keep doing it. The FEC only is allowing minor party to vote when they have 14% of the electorate voting for them. So you only get the first two perspectives, and you have to go to alternative media. So do you have any critiques or criticisms or improvements for the FEC, or, you know, what would gerrymandering is another issue? What would you have concerned citizens work on outside of the electoral season if they want to see a more direct vote and more direct democracy?
Well, I think direct democracy is the best approach. How to make it work well is a question. The Electoral College was essentially a device to protect the smaller states against the urban concentrations, and I think it would be very difficult to get that changed at this stage. Alaska's influence, insofar as any of it exists on presidential elections, would probably be even less if we didn't have the Electoral College. It's essentially not one that I would choose to battle on right now. I mean, the gerrymander is what I'm concerned about through the redistricting process that takes place every 10 years. And we had essentially a screwed up process this last time around. Essentially, one party districting board had a district that they extended from Fairbanks, I think the university district in Fairbanks, all the way to the Bering Sea, to Unalakleet or somewhere around there, because they wanted to minimize the influence of the university election district. So they tied it in ridiculous fashion. That and several other things they did. They went to court. The court says, whoa, you've got to rework this, this, and that. It went back to the districting board. They got rid of the worst example. But then another election was coming up, and there wasn't time to change it. So the court allowed whatever they did to revise it, allowed that to stand. And then everybody seemed to forget about it. And that is the system that existed up through this current election. We should have a better method. It'll be hard to get it through a legislature that benefits from a given gerrymandered system, because majority has a vested interest in it. It would require a constitutional amendment, not just the legislature. But the legislature would have to, by two-thirds vote of each house, would have to approve a new system, which then would go before the voters to be approved by the majority of those voting on the issue. It's a tough process.
What I would like to do, if we can move on from that, is to close out with this one last question that Wayne has.
Actually, it's to build on that principle about tyranny of the majority. Vic, I'll bring up an example that's quite prevalent right now. It's the majority of senior citizens don't want to give up their property tax exemption. So it's not one House versus Senate. It's the voters making it very clear that they would be unhappy if this thing went away. And to me, it's becoming a tyranny of the majority issue. So that's my personal.
Well, I don't quite understand. There are a lot more non-seniors than there are seniors. If the seniors are the ones who come out and vote, then it's time for the young people. Do I see any young ones here? The young people to pay attention and organize and get out and vote.
That is a great way to wrap this up, is get out and vote, and especially if you're young people or whatever age, get out and vote. It's that important. It is a precious right. Thank you very much, Vic, for coming to Homer.
Thank you. Thank you.
We appreciate your being here.
And my wife has the last word. Constitution, quick. This is something I always tell, quote to young school kids, not just young school kids, right up through seniors. The Constitution provides for certain rights. And if I can just get to it, I will tell you exactly what I'm talking about. Section 1 of Article 1 says, the Constitution is dedicated to the principle that all persons have a natural right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and the enjoyment of the rewards of their own industry. That's boilerplate. That all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protection under the law. This clause has been very important in Alaska Supreme Court decisions on equal rights, equal opportunities. And then it goes on, and that all persons have corresponding obligations to the people and to the state. And obligation number one for all the rights and opportunities that Alaskans have is to vote, to participate in their communities, it's an obligation to all of the state, to all of the people, and to any groups of people. And that was something that I never saw in any other constitution.
Good job, Vic. Good job writing the Constitution. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Yes.
This has been a community conversation with Alaska Constitutional Conventioner Vic Fisher, recorded live at Kachemak Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College on Tuesday, October 25th. The views expressed by the participants are theirs alone and do not reflect the opinions of KBBI volunteers, staff, or board. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. Thanks for tuning in.